it's Steve Tasker, who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual role player for you.
Steve.
A balloon.
Steve. A blimp. We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy. All right. We got the band back together here on a Tuesday. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you. One Bills Live is the show, and we're here until 3 p.m. Plenty to get to today. We've got a star-studded lineup for you of Bills players of yesteryear that should be entertaining, to say the least, and partly for a good reason, which we'll get to shortly, because of some coaching staff additions made to Sean McDermott's staff in the wake of some departures. So we'll get to that in due course here. But Steve wanted me to address my new little platform here on set. For those of you that can't see this, our MSG viewers, you know, see us every day, obviously. And we're behind a desk that it's like a crescent-shaped desk.
Right. It's a bar height.
But it's bar height. So like a regular office chair.
So Brownie feels comfy.
Yeah.
Feels
right.
At home.
So yeah. So a regular office chair it just doesn't work. It's not high enough. Like you would see my eyeballs
right. So
above
we,
the desk if got, I wore sat in an office chair.
They used to have us in barstool height chairs, right? I mean, so they had like the ring around the bottom where you put your feet on them and stuff like this. Now, when I started doing this, it was like 4 years ago, and I couldn't figure it out, but I started getting aches and pains, right?
In my legs.
I went to the doctor. They were gonna replace my knees, and I thought, wow, you know, career, you know, I had some work done. I said, well, it probably makes sense. And I was like, you know, I think it's the chair, you know. So Jay here, I go, Jay, fix me up. So Jay has the guys here at the stadium.
Operations guys,
they come over, and of course, those guys are come in with their tool. And it's like, I got this big 2x12 platform, like 4 feet by 4 feet that I have a regular desk chair.
An office chair, yeah.
All the problems I had, the knee replacement is now never going to happen. I'm good. I feel great, right? Meanwhile, Brownie has still been sitting on this bar stool.
And I'm shorter than you.
Right.
So, like, you know the little ring at the bottom of a bar stool office chair where you put your feet on? Like,
reach.
I am reaching and stretching for it with my toes. And so sometimes during a break, I'd get off the chair, you know, go in the control room, you know, talk with the guys about the next segment or whatever. And I got pins and needles in my feet. Because right. I like
that's what
I'm
was
cutting off the circulation to my
I was
feet.
My legs were killing me. So now since I was gone for the weekend, right?
Right.
I come back now. Brownie's got the platform.
I've got the same platform.
And
you.
He's back in fighting trim.
So I've got a regular office chair now, with armrests and everything.
Oh, it just makes it.
Yeah, I didn't think, you know, I had sat in that. I've sat on that side a couple of times
right.
when you were out. Or for one of the pregame shows during the season that I do with Maddie.
Right.
I'm like, man, this is nice. I got to get one of these.
It makes
things.
An incredible difference, doesn't
so
it?
So thanks to Jim Willoughby and other guys in operations that, you know, put this together for
and
me.
And I poo-poo that all the time because people say, well, I needed a new desk chair. And I was like, you just don't think about that as being a thing. Man, oh, man, what a difference it makes. And I know there's a lot of people who sit all day at the same spot and do stuff, you know, the counter or whatever, whatever. And – oh, my gosh. You got to have the right equipment.
I got to say, it's a weird feeling because I'm in an office chair, and yet I feel taller than I than I did in the bar stool chair. It makes absolutely no sense. I'm sitting at the same desk,
the best, man.
But for some reason, I feel taller. Somebody gave my chair lifts.
We are shifting gears, man, now in top fighting trim now because we're
ready to roll.
We are.
I mean, we are ready
so
to roll.
Ready.
So and we've got a great lineup for you today. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, we will be joined by former Bills tight end Lee Smith, who, as many of you know already, at the close of the season, which he spent with the Atlanta Falcons in 2021, he announced his retirement. We had him on here in December prior to the Bills-Falcons game here in Buffalo. And he gave inclinations then that he was close to the end and strongly considering retirement. I believe his oldest son is going to be in high school next year, wanted to catch him playing football, see his games rather than playing in games. So you totally get it.
Yeah.
And he's got a great, great post-playing career program that he has set up in Nashville. He's a Tennessee native. And it's basically a training center, a high-end, like, elite training center for prominent high school and college athletes to prepare for the next level. And he's got that thing up and running, and he's going to be doing that in his retirement. So good on him, you know, for having that post-playing career plan. Not everybody has a plan. He's got one, and it's like he's ready to hit the ground running with it now that he's retired. It's not like, well, you know, in a year we'll have this thing going. He's been planning this, and so we'll talk to Lee about that. And we have something up our sleeve when Lee comes in. We're not going to tell him what it is, but we're going to surprise him, and so you want to stay tuned for that. That's going to be a lot of fun.
Right.
Second hour of the show, we're going to get some key insight on Buffalo's newest addition to the coaching staff. The news broke last night. Aaron Cromer is the new offensive line coach for the Bills, but he had been here before. He coached Buffalo's offensive line in 2015 and 2016, two very successful seasons for that offensive line here in Buffalo, and one of the members of it, Eric Wood. Our good friend Eric Wood will be joining us in the second hour of the show to talk about Cromer and his strengths as an offensive line coach. He most recently has been with the L.A. Rams for the last, 2017 to 2020. He was with the Rams. So not this past season, but the previous four seasons, he had been working with the Rams as their offensive line coach slash run game coordinator. So we all know the exploits of the Rams offense over the last several years. They're in the Super Bowl. So we'll talk to Eric Wood about Aaron Cromer, how he operates, how he works with his players, the type of coach he is, the techniques that he preaches, and how that might fit with Ken Dorsey's offense. I think, Steve, a lot of Bills fans look at Aaron Cromer's resume, especially his 2 years here in Buffalo. I mean, the team led the league in rushing both years,
right?
2015 and 2016. They averaged 152 rushing yards a game in 2015 and then 164 in 2016.
Yeah, and granted.
And people are worried. They're like, oh, my God. It's going to take the ball out of Josh Allen's hand. Look, this team is not doing that. That is
right.
Not going to happen.
What
they're not doing that.
I was talking to you before the show. My take on this whole thing is it's not going to change anything either, but what it might do is this. I don't think they're never going to make this offense less dynamic than it was. They're going to try and keep it right where it was or go even further, make it even more dynamic, more deep balls, and put the ball in Josh's hands more. But I will say this. If you get a guy that can draw running plays and put together a plan – and remember, Tyrod was the quarterback, and he added a lot to the running game back then in 2015 and 16 when Cromer was here. Those guys, you know, ran the ball well, and Tyrod was the sprinkling. But here's what it'll do, I think. It'll give the offense a chance that when they're having trouble protecting Josh and they get into a game like they did in opening day against Pittsburgh or they get into a game like they did in Jacksonville, they give them something to go to get them out of a bad game, get them through a bad game and score some points, move the ball.
It's like using your second and third pitches as a major league pitcher.
If their running game can, you know, we don't have to wait till the last month of the season to get a running game that's effective, or if you go out there and you decide you want to run it and you go out there and put it in their face and you can make some hay whenever you want, That's a different animal than the Bills have been in over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. Yeah. And certainly they had a nice month of the season at the end of the year this year when Devin was going around and their offensive line finally got five guys on the field for more than, you know, the same five guys on the field for more than one or two or a game and a half. So they started to get some cohesion. But I think if Cromer can come in and help them get their running game to a point where it can get them through a tough spot where they're struggling to throw the football for one reason or the other. They can beat a team left-handed. They couldn't beat anybody left-handed this year. You know what I mean? They had to throw the football.
And I'll submit this too. When did Josh Allen play his best football this year? When did he play his most productive football?
At the end of the year.
At the end of the year and in the playoffs, when the Bills' run game was the most respected and productive it had been all year long.
Right.
So, you know, I think there's this prevailing notion that, you know, you get an offensive line coach whose biggest things on his resume are, you know, league-leading rushing totals and stuff, and people panic. Josh Allen has established himself as an elite quarterback in this league. The Bills are aware of it. Their offensive coaching staff is aware of it. The offense is going to run through him and his right arm, okay, primarily, more than anything else. It would be foolish not to. But there is something to be said to have a supporting cast that can provide something on the ground, in addition to Josh Allen's own legs, that provides production that can be counted upon when, as Steve pointed out, maybe the passing game isn't firing on all cylinders. So, in my mind, Aaron Kromer helps in that regard. And so, going forward, this should be an offense that still has its main focal point, which is Josh Allen, but also possesses the ability to beat you in a different way when things may not be looking like a well-oiled machine on a given Sunday. Right. In the passing game. That is enormously valuable.
That's what you've got to get to. And that's the perfect spot, because you got this guy in Josh Allen who, wouldn't it be nice if he started 2022 right where he left 2021 in the playoffs?
Oh my
gosh. I went to a family function where I grew up in Kansas. And, of course, everybody back there is gaga over Kansas City, and I get it. But I'll say this. Everybody out there was like, where we were, we wish that game was still going on.
Yeah.
Right? That's why you wanted to change the rules, because nobody wanted that game to end.
It was entertainment with a capital E.
And that's why – and even the Chiefs fans were like, wow. Because they, you know, they want to forget about their last game against the Bengals. They want to think about the Bills game as just as much as Bills and fans want to talk about the Chiefs game as well. It was just so fun to watch. And that's – you know, so if he can – if Josh can pick up in 2021 somewhere in that neighborhood – and go, particularly with an offense that, you know, sprinkles in a more solid and dependable and consistent running game. Yeah, okay. That's where the game's going. That's where you're going to hang your hat in 2022. And Josh and Diggs and whoever is the wide receiver. Of course, this is a roster. We don't know what it's going to look like. There's a ton of uncertainty about it. There's 16 guys on this roster, and they're contributors that are really question marks as to what they're going to do and what's going to happen to them. Plus, there's some guys that, you know, that didn't contribute like in the way you thought they would, that, you know, they may do something with them. So there's a lot of uncertainty headed into this offseason. I'd like to remind everybody before you panic or if you're having doubts, this is where they were last year too.
Yeah.
It's where they were last year.
It'll all fit together in due time.
That's right.
NFL news and notes. NFL Network's Ian Rappaport reporting the Steelers are scheduled to interview ESPN Monday Night Football commentator Louis Riddick for their vacant GM job. Kevin Colbert, after the draft, will be retiring as GM of the Steelers. So they are obviously in the throes of trying to find his successor in Pittsburgh. And I got to tell you, Louis Riddick would be over the moon to be the GM of the Pittsburgh Steelers, having played his college ball at Pitt. And I believe, you know, his other brothers all played in the state of Pennsylvania college ball.
Right.
So to be GM of the Pittsburgh Steelers, I mean, man, that's got to be a dream come true for him. So we'll see where that goes.
We've said it, too. I mean, he's been out of the league since 13, I think, something. He's been in the broadcast industry, right?
Yep.
So I've always been really impressed when you speak to him. There's a guy that's got a really good head on his shoulders, really smart guy, has been in and around the game at higher levels and behind the curtain as well. You know, from he's watched the sausage get made enough that he's got experience in how to deal with, you know, ownership and also the league office and other GMs. And just I think it's a good move. I like the guy. I got a lot of respect for him. We've had a lot of guys on our show as guests.
Yeah, we had him on our show this season.
And you listen to the guy talk, you hear him even as an analyst on TV, you get a sense of where his head's at and where his mind frame would be. I think he's a really strong candidate. I don't know anybody else that they're talking to, but man, oh man. It used to never happen, getting guys out of the media and coming in, since John Madden started doing that kind of stuff, where he came back and would advise the league and give and drop suggestions publicly, I think that they're more open to it, and I think teams are more open to it, and they should be.
Yeah.
They should be.
Joe Judge, the former Giants head coach, apparently is going to get hired by the Patriots to serve as an offensive assistant. There is speculation in New England that this hire is done with the long game in mind, and what I mean by that is reporters up there are giving indication that they believe Bill O'Brien will ultimately be hired as their new offensive coordinator now that Josh McDaniels is the head coach with the Raiders, and that Joe Judge will be the successor in waiting, because the anticipation is even if Bill O'Brien is installed as the new offensive coordinator in New England, it could only be a year or two before he's part of the next hiring cycle for head coaches in the league. I don't know how accurate that is. But it looks like they're trying to put a succession plan in place after losing a guy who had been their offensive coordinator for the better part of the last 10 years, after leaving once before for the Denver Broncos head coaching job and then coming back to the team. McDaniels was trying to get Joe Judge to be his special teams coordinator out in Las Vegas, but apparently he has chosen instead to go back to New England and serve as an offensive assistant there. Meanwhile, the Giants... You remember Brian Daboll at his press conference last week said he would have liked to retain current Giants defensive coordinator Patrick Graham, but he's been in line for a bunch of other jobs around the league after his head coach was dismissed, and it does not look like Patrick Graham is going to be back with the New York Giants because the Giants have hired former Baltimore defensive coordinator Wink Martindale to be their DC. So that looks like that has happened there. And really the only other interesting news on the coaching front that came down was NFL Network's Tom Pelissero is reporting that Chiefs offensive coordinator Eric Bieniemy's contract is expiring this year. It's not certain as to when it expired, whether it was end of the season, whether it's end of February. It's unclear. I think it might be more interesting that he was really only in the running for one of the open coaching positions. And this was one of the few years where he was available to be interviewed because his team wasn't in the Super Bowl.
Right.
And he still didn't get a job because all the jobs are closed now that Lovie Smith and Dennis Allen were hired by the Texans and the Saints respectively for their head coaching positions. So it really makes you scratch your head on Bieniemy. I know there are a lot of theories out there as to why he hasn't been hired yet as a head coach. I'm not going to add to the theories that are out there, but it does make me scratch my head a little bit. A guy that's been enormously productive in Kansas City, I'm sure when you have Patrick Mahomes as a quarterback, maybe that pulls some of the credit away from you to a certain extent because of the generational talent that he is, but still in all.
And also the credit your head coach gets
right,
for being
Andy
a play
Reid.
Caller. But it has been said that Bieniemy calls the plays in Kansas City.
Yeah, Andy Reid handed that over to him a couple of years ago,
right.
I want to say.
So there's that. Maybe you'd like to think, although in this climate, you never know. I mean, that it goes beyond him being African-American. Who knows? How many interviews he's had, what he has interviewed like, how the different interviews have gone. But like you say, it could be when you get him in a room, it seems like, Pat Mahomes is the guy that's getting it done over there, or Andy Reid's getting it done over there, or Tyreek Hill. They're so good in Kansas City, though, it just strikes me as impossible that he's not a
like
the candidate.
Right. I mean, because you see how, the hot, high-scoring offenses are what a lot of these owners tend to covet when they have a vacant head coaching position. I mean, look at all the guys. Look at some of the guys that got hired.
McVay, LaFleur, Kingsbury.
Kevin O'Connell is going to be named the Minnesota Vikings head coach after the Super Bowl's over, because by rule he can't be, because his team's still playing. But all indications are he's going to be the head coach in Minnesota. He's 36, you know. Mike McDaniel is getting hired as the head coach in Miami. The press conference, I believe, is today. He's 36 years old. This is what the owners are after, these hotshot offensive coaches, you know, that can help their quarterbacks.
Right.
That's really what they're looking at. And I understand the advantage, because if you hire the offensive guy as your head coach, you never run the risk of losing him because he's your head coach. I mean, unless you fire him. Whereas, you know, if you hire a defensive coach and you got an offensive guy working with a young quarterback, he develops him and they're successful, he's probably going to get plucked away by some other team to be their head coach, as we saw with the Bills with Brian Daboll going to the Giants.
Right. And it's become a defense mechanism for a lot of teams. One of their coordinators, or one of the major things, is done by your head coach, because you don't want to lose both coordinators in an offseason like the Bills thought they were going to the last couple of years. This year they lost one. So you want to have your head coach be able to step into that role with some confidence and some experience at doing it. Like, for instance, the Giants hired Joe Judge. He was a special teams coordinator. He never called plays offensively or defensively.
Right.
And so that's a different animal. Same thing with John Harbaugh. He got hired by the Ravens back in the day. He was a special teams coordinator. It's happened over the course of the year. But it has become that kind of safety net of, listen, we're gonna, as soon as we get good, we're gonna get poached, so we got to have some things in place to keep that from happening. One of them is to have your head coach call and plays.
Let's go to the phones at 803-0550 and talk to Tom in Buffalo. Tom, what do you have for us? You're on One Bills Live.
Hey guys, I was just thinking, is a concept for the Bills to go in the future. Should they hire all the free agent coaches that are out there, all the top ones that are available, so that as long as they're willing to collaborate with the other coaches, there's assistant coaches at every position. So I just think they should hire the best ones that are out there, bring them in. We got the talent. We just got to get over that hump. What do you think, guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think already, Tom, to a certain extent, the Bills have assistants at a lot of the positions. Like, Bobby Johnson was the O-line coach. His assistant offensive line coach was Ryan Wendell. Special teams. There's a special teams coordinator and an assistant special teams coach.
Yeah, we get a little
cumbersome.
And that's
been the case for several years. Yeah. I would say the only position groups where there isn't an assistant right behind them is running back, wide receiver, although the Bills have an assistant wide receivers coach. It's Mark Lubick, who's also, right, you know, game day strategy coach. Tight ends coach. They don't have an assistant tight ends coach here. They don't have an assistant running backs coach. But they have an assistant O-line coach. They have an assistant D-line coach. Linebackers is another one where I don't think they have an assistant here. But they have a secondary coach, John Butler. Mm-hmm. Then they have an assistant coach in Bobby Babbage. Then they have a nickel coach in James Salgado. So you got three coaches coaching the DBs. I mean, there are a lot of assistants on the roster already. Not only that, Tom, if you hire a high caliber assistant coach, you know, that's out there, and you try to make him like the assistant to the guy running the position group, if he's a high caliber coach, he's not taking that job because he knows he can get a better one. Why am I going to be the assistant to the tight ends coach when I'm good enough to be a tight ends coach and somebody will hire me for that? That's the rub there, Tom.
I think Tom's theory is that if you hire all the really good guys out there, you never have to hire any other coach. You hire them, and then when your guys get poached, they can come back. You got to have jobs for them.
Right.
They got to feel like they're contributing. I mean, if you got 55 assistant coaches on the staff, what are they all going to do? Plus, how do you get all the information that they can go out and get and bring it in and contribute on game day? You got 55 voices in the room all at once. That's cumbersome. I get what you're saying. You get a lot of creativity in that, no question. But you know, and then certainly there's no salary cap for the coaching staff. So, you know, if you can get, you know, Terry and Kim to, yeah, you can have, we'll start paying these guys a, you know, yeah, an extra 8 digits on our payroll. That's a, just to have them, just to have them on. Just have him on retainer.
It's a pretty big staff right now, I'll say.
Yeah, I mean, so
it's probably one of the largest.
I get
ones
what you're saying, but here's the thing: if a guy's a really, really good coach, you know, like a hot up and comer, all that stuff, reach out to him. Yeah, no question. See if you can get him. But you got to have a specific thing for him to do, a role for him to fill. You can't just have him just
a prominent
standing,
role.
Standing by. Yeah. He's because, you know, these guys, they want to coach. They don't just want to come in and have an office.
Right. We touched on this briefly late in the show yesterday, Steve. I wanted to get your take on it because I know we've had discussions about this. Kyler Murray unfollowed the Cardinals on his Instagram and Twitter accounts, pulled any Cardinals-related photos off of his Instagram social media page. It has led to some speculation in Arizona as to just what that means. He's not publicly expressed any desire to leave the Arizona Cardinals by any means. I mean, for gosh sakes, he's playing for the guy that coached him in college. That's his head coach. But the disappointing end to the regular season, as well as the bad playoff loss, has some Cardinals fans in Arizona panicking a little bit. And I was on with Thad Brown yesterday, and Thad put this in very good perspective. He goes, I guess this would be the equivalent of Josh Allen pulling all his Bills stuff off of his social media accounts, and what kind of uproar would that create? I mean, it would create a little bit of a panic situation. Now, you add in the fact, Steve, that when Kyler Murray got drafted, if you remember, there were questions about his commitment to the game of football because he was also drafted by the Oakland A's of Major League Baseball.
Well, you know what I've he's playing quarterback in the NFL, and he's playing at a high level. But he's got a baseball guy's mentality, and baseball's an individual sport wrapped around a team inside a team framework, and he's doing something. There's no question about it.
Yeah,
there is something behind it. What it is, maybe it's inconsequential, but if he's not self-aware enough to realize that this is putting the organization like they got to address it,
right.
And what are you doing? What are you doing?
You have to recognize your level of importance to the football team. You're the franchise quarterback. Stuff like that will get noticed. It will not go unnoticed. And you have to understand the potential speculation and repercussions that may follow actions like that. It might seem silly, but
If he's got a reason if he perceives to have a reason to do that, the club should already know about it.
Right.
If they don't know about it, if this is news to them, what are you, 6? Could pick up the phone like a man and call them. Say,
strange.
Listen, hey, I'm thinking, and calling Cliff Kingsbury and say, Cliff, from here going forward, I want to be able to have a voice here, here, and here in our meetings, in our draft, in our da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Make that happen. Let's just talk about making that happen. I want to step forward in the offseason and have a bigger voice in what direction that offense is headed. If that's all of that, a phone call works. Little subtle social media? Are you joking?
I don't know.
That's like middle school drama.
Well, yeah, it is.
What are you doing?
I don't know what to call it at this level, but it's definitely strange. And it's going to – people are going to follow up on this. People are going to start doing digging now because of this. And we'll see what gets unearthed. But it's definitely strange. All right, we have to take a break because when we come back, we will be joined by Bills former tight end Lee Smith, fresh into retirement. We'll check in with Lee next here on One Bills Live, presented by Collider Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. Welcome back to One Bills Live. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you. Pleased to be joined now by the man who spent 6 years of his 11-year playing career in a Bills uniform, including most recently the 2019 and 2020 seasons, And he is the pride of Powell, Tennessee, and he has finally called it a career. And we first say congratulations to one Lee Smith on a career that lasts a lot longer than the NFL average. I don't have to tell Lee. It's only about three and a half years for the average NFL career. He pretty much tripled that figure. So congrats on a long and distinguished career, Lee. How you doing?
Thanks, fellas. I'm good, man. I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Doing great. So you've announced your retirement. You're a couple of weeks in. Has anything been different now already, or are you just kind of still healing up, kind of getting settled after a long, hard season?
Yeah, man. You know, I've tried to lean on as many of my former guys that walked away as I possibly could and just pick their brains and try to figure out, you know, what landmines I needed to avoid as I transition out here. And I sure won't miss the off-season program, I promise you that. I don't think it'll hit me then, but I think once training camp starts and the season starts, that's going to be the biggest landmine. Right now, with the exception of really getting ramped up for some of these things that I'm starting off the field to help me with my transition, not much is different, you know, this year than any other year of my career up to this point. But once training camp comes around for the first time and, you know, 12 years, and I'm not a part of it, I think that'll be the time that it really hits me and I need to make sure I'm prepared.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it looks like you've laid some of that groundwork already. You know, you've got Triple F Elite Sports Training, you know, firing up here in Nashville, right? So, I mean, that's just something that you're going to be able to pour everything into now going forward. So maybe just tell us a little bit about that and where things stand in terms of that, getting that up and off the ground.
Yeah, I'm over in Knoxville. Dawson's in Nashville. Dawson's
oh, yes, okay.
Nashville. I'm just the old Knoxville boy. but yeah, man, kind of talked to Tasker and you guys last year, and I'll never forget Steve said, "Once play as many as you can, and then play one more." Well, I really do feel like this year was the one more. I just honestly don't think I can be the teammate and leader I've been, and man, and husband, and father, and all those things, if I go back at it. But yeah, man, Triple F, it's faith, family, football. It's something I'm extremely passionate about. I've always truly enjoyed mentoring these young cats and helping them kind of understand what it meant to be a pro. It'll be a much different mentor role now with 12 to 18-year-old young men and women. Just something that I couldn't be more excited about. I had a lot of adversity and stumbling blocks as a young man, a lot of it self-inflicted, most of it self-inflicted. And I just can't wait to be a huge resource for some of these youngins and just make sure they know that even when they get off the rails, there's still hope if they try to live on them more than they live off of them, and just try to make the world a better place here in my little local community. And as you guys know, I'm crazy as a road lizard. So, and that's a one-liner from Kyle Williams. I stole it. But man, I can't wait to let people know that it's okay to not be perfect. It's okay to make mistakes, but we're going to try to live right most of the time and do a lot of cool stuff, build a lot of good memories with these kiddos down here.
Well, you came into the league and you had this long and career where you were kind of a nuts and bolts kind of player. And most of, particularly here in Buffalo, they didn't make any bones about it. You had a role certainly in the offense. But you were here because you were a guy who mentored young players, guys like Dawson Knox, Tommy Sweeney, and you did the same thing with Kyle Pitts in Atlanta. And now you're going to do this with young kids as your thing. What is, say, give us one or two or a handful or of the things you got to start with. What are the foundational things that you're going to talk to these young men about to further their career, not just on the field, but as men?
You know, the first thing I want to do is build the coolest athletic environment for young kids in this area. I want it to feel like pro football, and I want it, you know, only such a few number of us get to really see what pro football feels like and that atmosphere and that brotherhood and the eliteness of it. And I want to have a place that everybody wants to be. And until I make that happen, I'm not going to be mentoring anybody. So once I can get all these young kids in the door and prove to the parents down here that I really am doing something different that's really special, it's going to be exactly that, Steve. Is man, like, once again, I was a very self-destructive kid that decided to take the wrong fork more than the right fork. And I just want to be someone that is available to these kids when I can tell they're continuously taking the wrong fork. And just to say that, you know, Jesus and strong men and this little, you know, safe place of athletics can truly change your life if you just lean on the good men around you. And it's not just going to be me. I'm going to have a whole staff of great men that love God, love these kids, love sports, not only football, but all sports. But mostly, man, just because you get off the rails doesn't mean you got to live off of them all the time. You look at Feliciano, my goodness. But you don't have to live off the rails all the time, man. You can make mistakes and get right back on them. And it's such a different world than when you and Jim were running around. All it takes is one snapshot with a camera and somebody taking a video of you for these young kids to kind of be off the rails so bad that it's hard to recover. I'm sure glad there were no camera phones when I was coming up. So that's going to be my deal for all these kiddos.
Yeah, well, we're talking about a lot of your old teammates. We got one here who just wanted to pop in on a surprise hello. So, Scott, take it away.
Hey, buddy, how we doing? Congrats on an awesome career. Just happy to be able to spend some time with you there in Buffalo. They were great years.
Absolutely, buddy. I put Scott was on the group text of all the veterans. Hey, man, thanks for teaching me how to be a pro, showing me the ropes. I spent more time with Scott in my first 4 years than anybody else in the league. So a lot of it has to do with him. He's obviously at his swanky ass place in Iowa. Look at that scenery.
Yeah, it's short sleeve weather here. It's almost 50 degrees here today. This is beautiful. It's short sleeves. I'm getting the tan today.
I love it. No, I appreciate it, brother. It's good to see your face.
Yeah, so
yeah, good to see you too, buddy.
So Scott Chandler joining us here, former Bills tight end as well. And I'm going to relay a funny story, at least the only one that I have, that involves both of these guys. So I'm watching practice. I think it's before the season, some training camp practice. And Lee's running a shorter pattern than Scott is in the passing game. I know that might be a shock to some people. And the Lee takes the check down and turns upfield to run up the sideline. And Scott, you know, doing the right thing on the play, he's looking to block downfield on Lee's behalf. And so Scott's block takes him to the same sideline that Lee is running. And Lee nearly runs him over at like a bulldozer. And so the play ends, and Scott looks back at Lee and says, "Why didn't you cut? Like, I'm blocking this guy out of bounds to the sideline. Why didn't you cut off my block?" And Lee simply looks at Scott and says, "I don't cut." You guys probably don't remember that.
My favorite thing Lee set up was my favorite find that he set up in our room was if you have to have people come out on the field to help you get off, it was a fine. And Lee broke his leg, got up and hopped off the field, and then I tore my ACL and they had to come out to me. And sure enough, we got back there and I got fined. It doesn't matter if you tore your ACL at the end of the season.
Wow.
You're still getting fined if they have to come get you off the field.
That's
the kind of accountability we had in that tight end room, you know?
Yeah, that's a tough crowd. That is a pretty tough crowd. And Lee, you've made the rounds around the league. You're in Buffalo. You were in Oakland. You were back in Buffalo. You're in Atlanta. You've crossed paths with a ton of players, coaches. What are some of the common denominators of, you know, truly great players, truly great friendships, great atmospheres? If you were going to be a head coach and an owner or GM asked you what was the foundational thing that you were going to build your program on, what would it be?
You know, obviously you have to have great players in our line of work. It's a production-based business, right? Four Super Bowls in a row for the Bills had a lot of Hall of Famers, so it's no secret why y'all won a lot of games. But, you know, it's easy to collect talent. It's hard to build a team, right? I know that the Bucks and Rams and some of these teams are proving that to maybe not be as true as I thought. But and NBA is sure proving it not be as true as I thought. But at the end of the day, man, when I walk into a locker room as a freshly fired player from the, you know, New England Patriots, and I've never played a down in the league, I'm scared I'm not going to be able to provide for my family. And a guy like Scott Chandler welcomes me with open arms the minute I walk in the door, and his wife, Alyssa, becomes family with my wife, and nobody was ever happier for any of my success than Scott. And when you have a bunch of selfless players that understand that we can all get our money, we can all get our success, we can all get everything we dream of and still truly be accountable to each other and wish the best for each other and be happy for each other, that's when a team becomes really special. So my thing, if I was building a team, would be, and it's, you know, it's Arthur Smith's big thing down in Atlanta is no egos. I don't care if you're going to the Hall of Fame one day like Matt Ryan, or if you're the, you know, practice squad tight end, egos are a cancer in the NFL. And when you have too many of them, it can become a problem. Don't get me wrong. One or two is fine. The rest of the Scott Chandlers and Lee Smiths, as they get older, can kind of keep the team together. But if you got an ego in every room on the team, as opposed to a veteran leader in every room in the team, you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah. And Scott, how good did it feel for you to see Lee kind of pay it forward in much the same way that you did for him as a young player coming up? Because when he came here for his second stint, I mean, he had young guys like Dawson Knox and Tommy Sweeney in the room here, and he kind of did the same thing you did for him. How gratifying is it when you see a guy that, you know, you mentored turns around and does the same thing?
Well, you know, I think what my relationship with Lee taught me as much as I ever taught him, I promise you that. He's an old soul, and you know, he was able to really teach me a lot of things about you know, growing up in a different environment than I grew up in, and empathy towards people, and I really think that, you know, he taught me as much as I taught him, and I knew that he would go on and be a leader. Just because by the time he was in his second and third year in Buffalo, he was already a leader. You know, he's natural that way. And you know, I'm really excited to see him go and impact a bunch of kids' lives in his community now. And, you know, he's just a great role model, great guy for kids to look up to.
Yeah, and now real quick, because I know Scott was very well received as a legend of the game up here this season, Lee. I got to believe you're on a short list. And that might be one of the few times where you'll be allowed to be a crazy man again. Your wife will let you be a little bit of a crazy man if you can be legend of the game to get this crowd fired up for a home game sometime.
I tell you what, man, I went and watched my son's eighth grade basketball kind of championship game the other day. And, you know, I said on the interview a few weeks ago, watching that Bills Chiefs game, I finally realized why these fans are so crazy. It's just the helpless feeling of having no control. There's something invigorating about that, man. And my son's little buddy, who they're the point guard and the big man on the basketball team, he crossed the dude over and just hammered a three ball. And I haven't been that excited or that emotional in 15 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, playing in the AFC Championship game a couple years ago with the Bills, that was a awesome ride there, trying to get the Super Bowl. We overachieved this year in Atlanta, in my opinion. You know, it's crazy we won seven games. You know, it's just the leadership and a kind of a young team and Cap Hell and all that stuff. Just the group of men that we were able to bring together and have that cool bond down in Atlanta was a lot of fun with Arthur's leadership. But even through all those moments, that, you know, 14-year-old young kid hitting that three in a big game was just unbelievable. It was just unbelievable, the rush that went through my body, to be honest. When I was playing all these years, I just sat in the stands and didn't say a word. But I said, you know, I'm going to embrace this non-player deal, and it's just the coolest thing ever. So I'll come up there. Maybe I'll bring some Tennessee moonshine with me one last time. We'll have Scott come up with me, and we'll have a good time.
All right. Lee Smith, Scott Chandler, you guys are great. Thanks for coming on and giving us a minute of your time. It's great to see you guys. Hope we see you back in Buffalo in the near future.
Thanks, guys. Love you, bud.
Yeah,
love you, bro. Tell us. I said, what's up?
All right, bye.
All right, man. See y'all. Right. Thanks, buddy.
Yep,
thanks,
you got guys. It. That's Lee Smith and Scott Chandler, a surprise guest joining us to wish Lee Smith well in his retirement. And I'm telling you right now, you want a guy to get a crowd fired up, Jeremy Kelly better get on the horn and put him on his short list for next season. Yeah. You want to get people amped up. That guy can get loud in a hurry.
Yeah.
And he'll have him frothing at the mouth. He'd be perfect for that role. Because Scott did a good job when he was in here doing it. And Lee, man, I mean, I remember him the first time he was here. He was a wild man. I mean, yeah, He said if it wasn't for his wife, he'd be somewhere in a gutter now. He said his wife basically, you know, put the bridle on him and reined him in, thankfully. So, heck of a dude. Both guys, really cool guys. And those were fun teams, you know, the Chan Gailey teams. They, you know,
yeah.
They had a tough time getting into the playoffs, too, but they were entertaining and fun.
Well, it's like, you know, it's the world we lived in back then in the latter years of the drought where, you know, you had moments and they were fleeting.
Yeah.
And those guys were part of some of the moments that made you feel like, you know what, I am going to cheer for this team. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, well, I think of the season opener.
You got to be grateful for those.
Think of the season opener in 2011. They go out to Kansas City, Chan Gailey, second year on the job. And they beat the Chiefs 41-7. Scott Chandler had two touchdowns in that game.
Right.
Those were the first two touchdown receptions of his career. It was like his fourth year in the league.
Yeah.
And guys like him got opportunities here then. And I think that's what made that team so fun to watch, even though, unfortunately, they couldn't get over that playoff hump. All right, we got to take a break. But when we come back, we've got an interesting tidbit that we happened to notice watching some of the Olympics coverage the other night. This is not something you always see. It didn't seem right to me. I checked it out. It was confirmed, and Steve thinks it's just as bizarre as I do. We'll tell you what we're talking about next.
First thing.
Here on One Bills Live, presented by Collider Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, back here on One Bills Live. Good conversation there with Lee Smith, congratulating him on his retirement. Scott Chandler joined in, former Bills tight end. So that was a cool conversation there. We wanted to change gears here a little bit because Steve and I have taken in some of the Olympics coverage out there in Beijing the last couple of nights. And so I'm watching the freestyle snowboarding, where they go down, you know, they go down a ramp just like a ski jump, and they've got a series of jumps, three or four jumps. They do their tricks. They get to the end, and they get, you know,
there's a couple of ramps.
Judged.
The one is there's a big air ramp there,
right,
and then there's another one where they've got a series of freestyle ramps that come down, like rails and stuff.
So I'm watching the coverage. They bump back from commercial break, and they're, you know, they've got one of those overlook scenic shots. And, you know, you see the ramp on the left side of the screen, and then almost seemingly immediately behind it, like I'm looking at it trying to establish the distance, and it's no more than 500 yards behind the ramp. There's nuclear power plant silos.
It looks like it leaning up against it. And I
looked at my wife. I said, is that a nuclear power plant? I think it is.
It is. Right next to it. They built the facility right next to the nuclear power plant and right next to the ramp and right next – the three of – is the, like, the cooling lake of – like this
I was just
lake
like,
right next to
– How did the IOC sign off on that?
And all the snow
the, I mean, that's what the International Olympic Committee does. They go to the site. Right. Okay, where are you going to build this? Where are you going to hold this event? And they do site surveys. Like, this is a common practice by the IOC. I don't know how you missed the nuclear power plant.
They put it right – and you look at where – they put it where the temperature was going to be what they needed for the event. And then they just put snow – you know, the snowmakers, like they do here in Western New York. They just mount snowmakers. And, I mean, there's just – like, and they got the sign, the Olympic logo on the stack.
One of the silos, yeah.
So when they picked the guy, when they picked the jumper coming off the jump, it's this big panoramic in the background, the Beijing 2022 Olympic rings are on the side of a nuclear reactor cooling stack.
Yeah.
I mean, I was like, whoa.
I was like, that's a first.
Really?
And I'm saying to myself the whole time, if I've got a kid in the Olympics, you know, a lot of these Olympians, they don't have their families with them because of all the COVID restrictions. They did not travel to the event. A lot of them are watching at home. We've seen the split screens that NBC has done showing families at home while their kids participating. If I'm seeing my kid going down this ramp and spending the better part of the next 3 or 4 days, 500 yards from a nuclear, I'm a little uneasy.
Right.
I'm a little uneasy about that. Am I wrong to think that way?
I don't know. I don't know how uneasy you'd be in the first place sending them to Beijing, but but it's not – you picture the Winter Olympics. Like, let's go to
the Winter Olympics this year in Aspen, right, or Vail.
Yeah.
And they go up, and it's the mountains, and all these venues
trees.
Are nearby the trees and the mountains, and you see the downhill over here, and over here is the ski jump. Da, 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 da. Yeah,
picturesque this is, vistas.
Now they've gotten to the point now with all the, with the technology and their ability to do it, and the cities that are getting the Olympics.
Make snow
they
anywhere.
They just build it, make the snow, and they build these things. Like the speed skating is like 80 kilometers from the village, and the jumps are like 25 kilometers over here. It's all spread out.
Yeah, they've got three different Olympic villages,
right.
And they house the athletes that are in closest proximity to the venues where they have to compete. Three different Olympic villages.
Right. So that's different. And in Winter Olympics, there's not that many athletes.
Not as many, for
it's
sure.
It's like
a third,
25 or 30% of the summer games. So the Olympic villages have got to be really tiny. And you saw the only snow in the entire shot there, the whole landscape of the countryside, it's a city with a nuclear reactor and a white hill.
All I'm going to say.
Man-made hill.
Is you don't have to worry about keeping your phone charged at that Olympic Village.
Oh, my gosh. That's
it's
so bad.
Powered by the plant right down the street.
I know. I saw that, and I was like,
I was fascinated
now
by
I'm
you just don't expect it.
I've been watching it for a couple of days. I watched some over the weekend. And because when you're out to dinner, we were out to dinner every meal because we were for a family event. And everybody's got the Olympics on because they're constant, you know. And I was like tapping. I go, look at this. It's got, is that a?
I did a double take. I was like, is that what I think it is?
So it must be the Olympic, the Chinese government saying, you know what, we're going to let people know that we've got, you know, a lot of technology and whatever. Because they've got to sign off on that, right? I mean, you could put that thing anywhere.
That's where they chose to put it.
Literally, and the Chinese government would put it anywhere.
Well, right.
They made that. That was a choice.
Yeah, power and strength. I think is what they're. That is not by accident at all.
Right.
No question about it.
Right.
No question.
Do they misunderstand the Western perception of what that looks like?
Doesn't look good.
Like putting your kids like.
Do the losers of the competition go into?
It's about like I've seen this. It's like the parent who's complaining about the street work and the sound and the noise it's making because his wife's pregnant. And she's standing there with a cigarette in her hand, right?
Oh man,
that's what it's like.
All right,
the Chinese that's the perception.
Right. It certainly was unexpected when I saw it on TV. I couldn't believe it when I saw that. Just being in such close proximity to the actual plant, it was.
Oh,
we had to bring it up. It struck me as supremely odd.
That's got
to
be our Western perception because certainly the Chinese perception would be one like they.
Well, they would argue it's clean energy, you know, clean energy. So, all right. That's we had to cover it in some capacity.
Wow.
I'm glad we did.
I'm
we have to take
you.
A break because coming up next, Eric Wood, who is going to tell us all about Aaron Cromer, Buffalo's new offensive line coach. Coming back for his second stint here in Buffalo, Eric Wood played under him for the two seasons he was here. He'll tell us all about Cromer next here on One Bills Live. Stay tuned.
Tasker, who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual-role player for you.
Steve.
A balloon.
Steve. A blimp. We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy here. All right, hour number two here on a Tuesday. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you. And as we mentioned in the first hour of the show, the Bills have a new offensive line coach by the name of Aaron Cromer, but it's not his first time here in Buffalo. He was here back during the 2015-2016 seasons. And centering that offensive line was the man who's joining us now. It's one Eric Wood, who's going to give us the inside scoop on the kind of coach that Aaron Cromer is. So, first of all, thanks, Eric, for joining us. Second, how would you best describe Aaron Cromer as an offensive line coach?
Well, I would say his strength is probably his ability to teach technique and to teach that to different body types and give you different tools at your disposal. He's very experienced. He's got experience under Howard Mudd, under Bill Callahan in many circles. Those are two of the better line coaches in history. He's taken techniques from each of them, and then he is just a Rolodex of things that he could teach you. And for me as a player, I felt like this took my game to a next level, because throughout the first part of my career, it was a lot of, you know, our O-line coaches were excellent, but they would band the group together and it's go, we're going to go physically dominate these guys. And Kromer has some of that in him, but a lot of it is technique with him. And so I've already texted a few of the guys in Buffalo and let them know that Aaron Kromer is a guy that I have a lot of faith in. He's a guy that took my game to a new level, and I think he'll do an excellent job with this group.
And when he comes in, we don't know what this group is going to look like. There's a couple of guys that are going to be here and going to be there. You talk about how fast it has to come together. I mean, when these guys get together it's going to be in like another 2 months or 3 months, 2.5 months before they come in for OTAs, just after the draft and all of that, how fast will these guys start to, you know, it's going to be like coming to a new team almost for some of them, with new faces, new coach, all of that.
Yeah, there's going to be a new guy running the offensive room for the first time in a while, with Brian Daboll departing for the Giants. For these offensive linemen in particular, they'll have a new guy running their offensive line group. This group was used to Bobby Johnson. And as much as I'm praising Aaron Kromer, I thought Bobby Johnson was a great offensive line coach for the Bills. And he was great under my time under him when he was at Buffalo prior. So that being said, I would assume that a lot of the terminology stays the same. Ken Dorsey's been in this system for a few years. I would assume that he kind of just picks up where they left off. A lot of it will look the same. I think a lot of the terminology will be the same, because you have so many returning faces on offense. As far as the players go, you want to make it as easy as you possibly can on them. And then as far as Chrome coming in, they may have some new terminology with their techniques, with their calls at the line of scrimmage, which sometimes isn't a bad thing. You know, when you've played in the same scheme and you're playing against divisional opponents twice a year, they hear your calls. At times they can get a beat on what you're doing. Sometimes having some different calls and some different terminology at the line of scrimmage especially can be valuable for you.
So maybe explain for the layman, Eric, when you have a new offensive line coach coming in and the scheme, as you mentioned, is expected to stay relatively the same, what is the process by which that new O-line coach incorporates those techniques that he teaches to the scheme he is now inheriting?
That's a great question. And it kind of depends on who it is. When you hire an Aaron Kromer, you're hiring him because of his experience, and you think he could bring something to the table. He is from my understanding, he was pretty sought after. There were some other options out there for him. And when you bring in an Aaron Kromer, you're saying, hey, we want you to teach what you do. And now Ken Dorsey is a first-time play caller. He may be aided in the fact that Kromer has called plays before. He's scripted an offense before. And so he could be an asset for Ken Dorsey. But when you ask specifically about the techniques, Kromer's going to watch what these guys did on film last year, and assuming that most of the plays are similar, he's going to see what worked and didn't work, and he's going to try and give them some answers for maybe some things that didn't work.
And what do you look for is, and there's this big thing now where you got Aaron Kromer coming in. He's been, you know, he's a run game coordinator. This is going to change the philosophy. It's going to, you know what I mean? And our take on it has been, listen, this is just, if they can get a running game that shows up before it did, you know, like a month and a half, maybe it gives the Bills a chance to, they're still going to be a throwing football team, but maybe it gives the Bills a chance to beat some teams left-handed if they can't protect Josh in one game, like the Pittsburgh game or the Jacksonville game where they hung up 6 points and 10 points respectively. Maybe it gives them a chance to score more points in a game where their passing attack has been stifled for some reason or other.
Yeah, I mean, Kromer was a big reason that we led the league in rushing in 2015 and 2016. He goes to L.A. after the entire staff was let go, and they were successful at running the football under Sean McVay. And to my knowledge, that was his first time in a Shanahan-style offense. I'm sure he has some wrinkles that he can suggest. But they're going to look at this group in that last maybe 6 or 7 games. Devin Singletary was so effective running the ball, and a lot of it was toss crack schemes. A lot of them were pin and pulls. And then you had the element of the read option. That's where he was most effective. And so Kromer's going to look at that. Ken Dorsey's going to look at that. And everybody on the that offensive staff is going to come together to kind of aid Ken Dorsey in this transition. But ultimately, it's Ken Dorsey's offense. It is not Aaron Cromer's offense. When you look at this 2022 Bills offense, it will be judged by Ken Dorsey. So for those out there that think, well, now that we hired Aaron Cromer, now the Bills are going to run the football more, and it's going to be a 50-50 split, something we were used to seeing prior to maybe 2019. Well, that is not going to be the case. Yeah. This Bills offense, the strength of it is Josh Allen, is that receiving core, that tight end they got in Dawson Knox, who became a weapon in 2021. They are going to utilize those weapons.
Right. And I think the perfect description of maybe ideally what this new offensive staff is after was seen in the Patriots playoff game, the wild card playoff. The Bills threw for 308 yards, ran for 174, and had 13 first downs passing, 14 first downs running. That's the ideal formula, I think, for this new offensive staff coming in, isn't it?
Yeah, I would think so. And now something that aided that run game against the Patriots, especially some of those third downs, were Josh runs. And I still think when you look at desperation time for the Bills, games that you got to have, crucial third downs, you'll utilize Josh in the run game. But as he gets older, I believe that you'll see less and less runs designed for Josh. Now, he'll always have that ability to scramble, but I think you'll see less and less design runs, especially because Ken Dorsey got to take a front row seat for the beating that Cam Newton took in Carolina, and understanding that the health issues that brought on with Cam Newton. But to your point, Brownie, I think that it says a lot about Sean McDermott's comments all throughout kind of that mid part of the year, and then what the offense ended up looking like when he wanted more balance. And balance in the NFL isn't necessarily a 50-50 split. It's being able to run the football effectively so that your play action, which the Bills run as much play action as anybody in the league, I expect that to continue, but you've got to be able to run the football effectively, especially with your running back, to get those linebackers to suck up towards the line of scrimmage.
Do you think there's a prevailing attitude among coaches, not just here with Buffalo and Josh Allen, but also with anybody, particularly in the AFC, who's got a Justin Herbert, a Josh Allen, a Lamar Jackson, a Joe Burrow, I mean, Pat Mahomes. Okay, these guys, they're all athletic, they can all run, but we're not going to be coaching too long if they're not playing quarterback for us, right? So they've got this asset that they've got to be good stewards of and make sure the guy lasts, right? I mean, so as you got this game, you got to win, but if you're going to use your guy up, a la Cam Newton in Carolina, you've got to come up with ways to take the load off of him, and the running game would be the perfect candidate for that.
Yeah, I think it's the run game. I think it's that quick passing game to the outside, which are extended handoffs. And, you know, early in Josh's career, we saw a lot more design runs because they were trying to win games, and Josh wasn't as polished of a pocket quarterback as he is now. Now that he's developed into the passer and decision maker that he's become, now you don't have to use him as much in the run game. Now, with his athleticism, if he even fakes like he's going to keep the ball, he's got to keep defenders honest. Especially when he's in the shotgun and he can run that read option, he could just steal 20, 30 yards so fast, which, heck, that's 5 to 10% of a lot of teams' output in a game.
Yeah.
Right.
We know that Coach McDermott several times during the course of last season said that his guys in the trenches had to be more physical. I think they did a better job of embodying that over the final month of the season in the playoffs. I would, you know, having been there in 2015 and 2016, I would argue that you guys were a pretty physical offensive front under Cromer. Where does he come down? I mean, you touched on it a little bit earlier, Eric, but where does he kind of come down in that part of the game for this group going forward, you think?
You know, I'll say this. I think a lot of our physicality in 2015, 2016 came from the personnel of the group. It's hard to coach physicality on a down-to-down basis. You can get your group as riled up as you want throughout the week and on the sideline. Midway through a drive, you kind of fall back on your training. And if you're a physical type person, if that's your personality, then you're going to play more physical. And I'm not saying the guys who are playing at the midpoint of the year weren't playing physical. They're not physical people. I just think as you settled in to your group at the end of the season, that group was playing physical. Spencer Brown, when you watch him play football, I don't want to say he reminds me of myself, but I would have liked, if I played like that as a rookie, I would hope people would say, man, that's the type of guy that I can build around. And no, it's not perfect, but that guy finishes every single play. Right. Deion Dawkins was like that early in his career. Those are two physical tackles. Ryan Bates came in there and played a physical brand of ball. I'd say Mitch Morse, his strength is his athleticism and how smart he is. That's not a knock on him. That's his strength. But he can also be a physical blocker, especially when you get him on the move. He's outstanding pulling. And then Darrell Williams at right guard, he's more of a natural tackle. He's long, but, man, he can play physical at times too. So when you settle into a group, then – and the Bills finally settled the group. That's when they started to see that physicality. But, you know, and Brownie, one more thing on that. When you know you're going to run the football more, the physicality comes out a little bit in the offensive line. It's, I always heard that pass pro is not passive. Like, we're trying to shock the defenders. If you got a guy stood up, we want to wipe him out. If he jumps for a pass, you want to slam him. Like, pass pro does not have to be passive. But when you're retreating each play, it's hard to be a physical O-line or be known as a physical offensive line.
If all these things happen and Kromer comes in and they formulate this offensive line into the kind of thing we're looking at, what will that to you and a casual fan, the Bills fan who doesn't study film and who, you know what I mean? What's it going to look like differently, if at all, than it did this year or last year?
For a casual fan, if the personnel stays the same, it'll look very similar, you know, because this Bills offensive line, I went to bat for them week in and week out, and it was tough with all the rotations and all that. And I'm not saying they were perfect this year. I'm just saying as a Bills fan, sometimes you can get really locked in on some things we're doing and not look around the NFL and see that there's a lack of talented offensive linemen across the league, especially as the season goes on and guys start to get dinged up. Some of these players that are hopping in there, putting out some embarrassing film. That being said, you know, I'm trying to think, you might see a little bit more jump setting from the tackles to give fans maybe something to look for early on in the season, maybe the preseason. If he gets a tackle, let me say this without cursing, who's a little light in the butt, then who doesn't have a strong anchor, he'll jump set a guy with Aaron Kromer. He will try and get his hands on him as quickly as possible so that you stop his momentum. Well, a lot of things that the Bills were doing these last couple of years in pass protection, now you're sorting half the field. You have to scoop back so that you can sort it out. I think you'll see a little bit more jump setting with the Bills offensive line, which can mean two things. One, it can give Josh a much firmer pocket where guys aren't in his lap. But if you get beat on a jump set, that guy's coming quickly at Josh Allen. And I will say this, and I'm trying to think, maybe Lamar Jackson, but for pocket presence and making single defenders miss in the pocket, I have not seen anybody better over the last 5 years than Josh Allen.
Yeah, right. Eric, thanks for spelling it out for us and giving us the 411 on what we can expect from the Bills' new O-line coach. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. My pleasure, guys.
All right. That's Eric Wood joining us here on One Bills Live, telling us all about Aaron Kromer, having worked with him on a daily basis for the better part of two calendar years when the Bills, oh, by the way, led the league in rushing. 152 yards per game, averaged 4.78 yards per carry in 2015. And then in 2016, led the league in rushing again, 164.4 yards rushing, averaged 5.35 yards per carry. Now, that's with Tyrod Taylor as a running quarterback as well. That always helps the numbers. And Shady, obviously. I think if they can make their run game even more effective, more consistently strong, it's better for the offense. It just is.
Yeah. Absolutely. There's no reason, except for the great experiences we've had over the last 2 years of watching the Bills go in 2020 in the pandemic year, going to the AFC Championship game, and then watching them finish the year and go through the year where Josh was virtually the exact same guy in 2021, how fun that has all been. But it'll be interesting to see, and this is what their goal is. You know this, Brownie. The goal is to get them better, not just to be as good as they were last year, but to get better.
Yeah.
And one of the real ways they can do that, particularly if they get their wide receiving room the way they want it, because they got, you know, they've got some issues there, Isaiah McKenzie, they got, you know, some guys. The running game is a really great starting point. And you can bet that that's what's going to help Josh and everybody else play better in the passing game.
is a running game that they can depend on throughout the year, not just kind of hope it emerges out of something or other.
Now, on this show, Steve, we are not ones to claim to know everything and anything about football or anything else for that matter. So when we are wrong, we call ourselves out, okay? And our fine listening audience has brought it to our attention that the silos behind the ski jump at the Olympics are actually not a nuclear power plant. So apparently it's the former site of steel and iron mills that are no longer being used in that capacity. Yeah, as part of a revitalization project, the silos now house office space, snowmaking gear, restaurants, museums, and even a wedding venue. So thanks to our listener, Matt, for setting us straight on that. That's a relief, to me anyway. Because
yeah, it was a steel mill. That doesn't look like a steel mill.
Not
in the
steel mills we remember.
Right. So that, fine, that's good.
That's good.
So that's, they repurposed.
I'm glad we were wrong.
Right, they repurposed the world's largest steel mill into stuff.
Yeah, you know, I guess back in 2010, there was so much waste and pollution being produced by that steel mill, because it's the largest one in China, I believe. They said, well, we either got to just shut it down and raise it, or use it for something else. So they cleaned it up and used it for something else. So good on the Chinese government doing right.
Now it's a gathering place, you know, for offices, restaurants.
Now it's the site of an Olympic venue. So go figure.
Yeah, kind of cool.
Hey, look.
There you go.
When we call it wrong, I'll own up to it.
That explains putting the sign on it and showing it.
That's right. Still, it was a weird look. I got to
say,
I was taken aback.
Problem solved. Let me just say this. I feel better.
I do. I feel better about it,
I feel better.
It's one of the instances where I'm glad I was incorrect in describing what we were looking at there.
I am glad that somebody took it upon themselves. It's amazing.
Got to believe it's a lot healthier for the
athletes. Social media coming through in its most positive way ever. How about it?
There it is.
Who'd have thought? Unlikely things for 500, Alex.
That's right. That's where we were. Are you amazed by what some of these athletes can do in the air on a snowboard or on skis? Because I'm just going to say this, Steve. I was never a huge fan at any point in my life putting my butt over my head for anything.
Right.
Like, that just flies in the face of anything that seems smart.
Yeah, that – yeah, I'll just leave that alone. But, yeah, I – same.
Like, inverted.
I had some –
no!
I'll say this, and I'm an old guy now, but back in the day, I had some gifts.
Well, yeah, you can do some backflips and stuff. That's not me.
And that's still, to me, most people, because I can put myself even mentally now, even as an old guy, back to where you were in that zone where you're competing and you're going to do something. You just kind of do it. I can't tell you how courageous it is to slide down the hill and do the spins and twists and flips and all of that, and come and trying to land it, because you can say what you want about covering a kickoff in the NFL, particularly back in the day when it was still kind of dangerous. That's a different. It's a courage that you have to come up with to compete at these, like these people.
Well,
do.
Yeah,
these are young kids. I mean, they're teenagers, some of them in the early 20s, most of them, and. You know, I get it. You're young, and everybody's bulletproof. You know, who cares?
The amazing thing to me is how far some of these freestyle skiing sports, whether it's that half pipe, which we'll probably see in the coming days, or whether it is the freestyle stuff going off of ramps and stuff.
Right.
I mean, in the span of 10, 15 years, we've gone from like 900s, which is three full revolutions, I believe. Or three and a half, actually.
It's 12.
Now they're up to like 1440s and 1620s. They're doing four and a half revolutions in the air.
The triple, yeah.
Upside down.
Yeah. They're.
What?
And it's amazing. And you see, they're coming down from like four and a half, five stories in the air. They're going. Now they're
sticking the landing.
And I'll say this
backwards.
Too, the Olympic Committee and the Olympics and the people who know this sport have built these things as safe as they can. So when the speed they come off with, the ground follows their arc so that they're never really high in the air.
Right.
Because when they come down, they're just, you know what I mean? they build the hill so
the curvature
that the curvature of it follows the arc of their jump, so that when they come down, they're not dropping from 65 feet down to,
you know, right. I don't that's know, a 55, hard landing.
Yeah, whatever, 50 feet, 35 feet, drop down into a flat surface. They get all of that, but man, oh man, to go down that hill backwards, some of them.
I like the ones that start backwards.
Right.
They go right to the jump backwards.
They come down backwards.
Careening down.
It's amazing. It really is courageous. And I'll say this, too. Even the figure skaters, and I know some people poo-poo the figure skating, they do this guy, Chen.
Oh, the quad jumps.
He landed two quads and a triple last night and got the highest score ever in men's short program.
Yeah.
And listen, this is one thing I can relate to. I can't do a quad. I can't even do a single. I can't hardly skate, but I know what it is to fall. And there ain't no forgiveness in ice.
Plus the torque and the spin in which they are propelling themselves.
They don't build the ice in the arc of your jump. I know that.
And you land wrong with that kind of torque and power. Like, you bust an ankle in 3 seconds.
Oh, you go down on the – you don't wake up. So it's I mean, you're down. That ice is what it is. It is hard as rock.
Yeah, it's unforgiving.
And it's the courageous, you know, the ability and the desire to compete like these people do in the Olympics. It's been fun to watch. I was going through a stretch a few days ago where I was like, I don't know, But even so, there's so many things there, and it's a lot of fun. I found myself, just like I did in 1972 when I was 10 years old, captivated. Just captivated by some of the events. And that goes all the way from the stuff like this, what we're talking about, these people flying all over the air, and curling.
Get the brooms, man.
I'm telling you this, though. NBC's got to get somebody with it, like I used to have in the booth, the telestrator. What are you looking at here? They've got their little sticks, and they're pointing to this. I go, what are they trying to do? Show me. And they need to have the guy that draws the line on the screen, so he's going to try and knock this here and do this here.
Yeah.
And curl it in like this. Draw it for me. I need that. That's one thing they're missing in their production.
All right.
That's
one to take to the bank there, NBC. Make a note of it. We have to take a break here. Steve and I back with more in just a second here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, Steve. So we haven't done this in a while. It's been a minute since we played a little bit of NFL True False, brought to you by Yancey's Fancy, New York's artisan cheese. So it is Super Bowl week, so why not fire up the NFL True False? And we begin with NFL True False number one. The only way a team wins a championship this year is if it has a defense that is actually legit. True or false?
Now I'll say, I don't know. What's legit?
That's a good question.
I mean, let's define our terms.
Well, let me.
I'm going to say no, because most of these teams' identities are all wrapped up in the quarterback and the offense. So yeah,
that is true.
The defense will make some plays or can make some plays, even have a good game. But that's not the reason they're going to win the championship. They're going to win the championship because they got in the game and they got an actual chance to play in it, and their offense did the job for them. That's why. So no, I'm going to say no.
Rams are sixth in the league against the run, fifth in sack percentage, 15th in points allowed. Cincinnati this season, 5th against the run. So both of them are top 10 run defenses. And then the Bengals are 14th in sack percentage. And let's see, 17th in points allowed.
Yeah.
So
I'm saying false.
Based on those
are legit defenses.
Yeah, they are.
But let's face it. It's hard to play defense in the NFL.
It is. And I think it's only going to get harder because I think more and more the NFL game is going to start looking more and more like the college game. And what are the college games every week? They're up in the 30s and 40s routinely.
Right.
And I think we're going to see more of that going forward in the NFL, which is music to the ears of the owners in the league at large, because more points means more viewers because it's more highlights and more plays.
See where it's going. Now, the league will fight against it a little bit. If they feel like it's getting too soft or too much of one thing or the other, they'll change it and they'll bring it back. They'll pull it back
a little bit.
But right now you've got an environment in the league where, and I'm just generalizing, so I don't mean this tech. I'm just going to say it. It's easier to play quarterback now than it ever has been because they're protected. That's why you got quarterbacks running all over the place, and it's accepted. It's accepted practice to slide. If you slid back in the 70s and 80s, you still got whacked. They didn't care. They were going to touch you down with the top of their helmet,
right,
on your head. So it's easier because the guy, you're not risking your quarterback by giving him the ball and letting him run it.
Yeah.
So it's – and now, too, with the free releases and the restrictions they have in the secondary, quarterbacks are making able to make throws. Well, you think about the – think about the New England game last year, Monday Night Football in New England. I don't want to get into this, big, go back in the day. Josh hits Steph Diggs, and while he's in the air, he gets whacked by the safety, but he doesn't even go off his feet because he can't get hit in the head.
Yeah,
or
the defenseless receiver.
He comes
rule.
Down and walks into the end zone. That's a throw you don't make back in other eras.
Yeah.
So it's easier to play quarterback now than it ever has been, and I think when you talk about how the league is going, it's going to be either more of that, or it's going to get to the point where it's almost repulsive, like it's so easy, and they're going to have to start beefing up the ability for teams to play defense.
I will say false as well, because the quarterbacks have been the main drivers of these two teams getting to the Super Bowl. But I will say that the one big reason why the Bengals are there too is not just, you know, the talents of Joe Burrow. The defense has gotten hot at the right time for Cincinnati. They were never a poor defense. They were a slightly above average defense for much of the year. And then they got hot at the end of the year. And they have six takeaways in their three postseason games. Like, they're getting turnovers to give the offense more opportunities. They're pressuring the opposing quarterback with great success. And it's made a difference. I don't think Cincinnati gets there if their defense didn't get hot in the postseason.
Right. If turnovers are a thing, a predictable thing, then, you know, If you're getting turnovers, your defense is legit. But it's the most unpredictable thing you can ever think of in a defense. You can't game plan.
Because if those go away in the Super Bowl on Sunday,
you lose.
The Rams probably winning the game.
Yeah, but if neither team, that's the thing. You got to match them with no turnovers yourself.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way that runs. So, yeah, I'll say false.
Yeah, I think I'm saying false, too, at least for now. NFL true false number two, coaches relied too much on analytics in making decisions this season. This is an interesting one.
I'm going to say false. I mean, analytics make a lot of sense, and they get into some places where you got to – no, I'm saying false.
Yeah.
Analytics are – I mean, it's data and it's probabilities. That's what you got to do. You're supposed to do that. So when you get away from that is when you get into trouble.
And the other thing too, Steve, this is a difficult question to answer because we don't know specifically how much each coach on each team relied on analytics.
You know what,
they did to some degree, but too much? How could we
think
quantify
about this?
That?
You know when teams get into problems? So when they get away from analytics and do stuff that is completely subjective. Like, I'm going to challenge that throw. Like McVay in the playoff game with the Niners?
Yeah.
I mean, what are you doing? That's not analytical.
That is unanalytical.
And that's where he got into trouble. That's where he almost blew the game.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm going to say no. That they did not.
I will say false, too.
Analytics,
I mean,
too much.
We do know that the true value of analytics is not realized unless it is used in a purposeful way. And even if you can't be predictive with the analytic information you have, because that is the holy grail, and in many cases it's very difficult to find or acquire, you know, predictive analytics is the holy grail, and it's very hard to find. The information that they have, as long as it's being used in a purposeful way to make better decisions in games, coaches will continue to use it. I think they've reached that point now in certain areas of football. But to say they're relying too much on it to make decisions to the point where they're using it in a vacuum, I don't know if we can go that far, so I will say false as well. NFL true false number three, expansion to a 40-team NFL will eventually work. 40 teams. That's eight more than you currently have.
Eventually, like in 2022? I mean, what are you
talking
about?
I think we're talking about like 2032. 2035.
No.
It won't work, you say.
No. And I've had conversations
at length back in the day when Carolina and Jacksonville came in the league.
Yeah, 95.
The last time.
Well, Houston is the last expansion
right.
team.
Well, Houston, Cleveland.
Yeah. Right, 99 and 02.
I had conversations at length with people that were up in that end of the league, and I said, well, you know, what are they going to do? Are they going to put teams, you know, they're going to add teams like in London, Berlin, Paris, you know, have a division overseas or whatever.
A European division.
Right, and their opinion at that time, now this was, you know, 20 years ago, their opinion at that time was this, they were like, mm-mm. And I said, well, why not? I said, we're having trouble now finding enough good players to field 32 teams. Because once you get down below, like, the first-round draft picks, third-round draft picks and all that, then you'll see stragglers. But there are more players leaving the game than there great players leaving the game than there are great players coming in. And the league is filled with just guys. You know, hence the 3.5 year average career. That right. means for all the guys like Brady who played 20 years and Drew Brees and Ben Roethlisberger and Matt Ryan and, you know, on and on and on. And like Lee Smith we had on the 10-year guys, there's 30 who play 1.5 seasons.
Yeah.
And that's their career.
Because they're not good enough to stay.
Because they're not good enough to stay for whatever reason,
yeah.
and injuries and all that. But so that's – so I think 40 team, I don't think there's enough – players to do it.
Well, you can always find
NFL
players,
level.
But you're talking about quality of player.
The
quantity is there.
They would think
the quality probably.
They would think that there would be so many teams that were non-competitive it wouldn't be worth it.
Right, and I will say false also. I mean, we just talked to Eric Wood, who was just espousing on the fact that NFL teams right now with 32 clubs have a tough time fielding good quality offensive lines on the field. Forget about the entire roster, just the offensive lines alone. If you
right.
lose one starter to injury, there's a drop off
yeah.
for a lot of teams that they can't recover from.
No.
And so you want to expand it to 8 more teams.
Now, certainly,
the quality of the on-field product is going to go down precipitously.
Certainly there are worldwide plenty of athletes for 40 teams, but none of them are trained to play football. You've
yeah.
seen how hard it is for European guys in the European pathways
to adapt to this game.
You know, Christian Wade is a good example. F.A. Obada has done it. And then there are others. You know, the Patriots had a guy this year as well. So there are guys who can do
Jacob
it.
Jacob Johnson, right.
But, you know, you need – like, seriously, you need like 200 of those guys a year.
Yeah.
For just to get to a place where you have 4 teams in Europe. So
it's a heavy lift.
It's a heavy lift. And it's going to take generations to get the game, the interest of the game enough so young players will take up the game and be good enough and develop enough and be in a league that's challenging enough to make them great.
Yeah.
So it's a long way off, and I got to say false.
Yeah, we went false across the board there for Yancey's Fancy front to back. NFL True False brought to you by Yancey's Fancy, New York's artisan cheese. We break now. Steve and I close it up next here on One Bills Live. Back One Bills Live, Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you. And if we think for a second, Steve, about the new pieces on the offensive side of the ball in the new roles on the coaching staff, namely Ken Dorsey, OC, Joe Brady, quarterbacks coach, Aaron Cromer, offensive line coach, what is your anticipation of that blend? Because you've got a veteran guy in Cromer, you've got a young up-and-comer in Brady, and you've got a guy who's ready to embark on a new chapter of his career in Dorsey.
Yeah, I think it's a. It looks on the surface, it looks like a perfect mix. A guy who's been entrenched in the offense for 4 years, getting ready to take over the reins, and he's gotten learned from a guy who is considered phenomenal at it. A young guy who wants to be that, and a guy who's been through it at the highest levels in his run game and passing game, and done the job for other teams. Certainly, it all comes down to their relationship. Well, hopefully that flourishes.
Yeah, working with one another might be
That's it.
The biggest hurdle because they all seem pretty accomplished. So we'll see. Time will tell and it'll make OTAs in the spring very, very interesting. Steve and I are done for today. We'll be back tomorrow as we begin some Rams coverage with former Rams running back Doc Holliday joining us. We'll see you tomorrow at 1:00.